Big thanks to you, Suze, for a really nice talk on introducing this whole subject of the five aggregates and going over the first two of form and feeling tone. So now I'm going to go ahead and talk about the other three, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. And I think one of the senses you'll get from Suze's talk is how closely related these things, these aggregates are, and how they just sort of arise almost in a cluster. So some of them that are arising, if you begin with one, the others follow very quickly. So there's just this sense of they all kind of come together. So we can start with the aggregate of perception first. So far in our exploration of the aggregate, Suze has talked about this aggregate of form, coming in contact with form, especially the form of the body, the sensations, and also about how when we come in contact with something like that, this object registers some kind of a feeling tone. Unpleasant, pleasant, or neutral. And then we get to perception, and this is the point where the mind recognizes and names the object. So we take whatever this thing is that we're experiencing and we make it into something that's recognized and identified. Our mind does this process. So for example, if we were taking a walk outdoors, perception comes into play when the mind notes, oh, that's a maple tree, or this is sun, this is a breeze I feel on my skin, this is a blacktop road that I'm walking on. So the mind is just kind of thinking, oh, I know what this is X. And along with this kind of perception or definition comes an idea or a concept about what this particular object is. And like all of the aggregates, this process is completely natural. It's really unavoidable mental activity. It just happens. I mean, we're almost not even aware that it even is happening. And so definitely, you don't need to have the sense that there's something bad about this process, that we need to stop it or avoid it in any way. You wouldn't really be able to stop it or avoid it anyhow, I don't think. It would be pretty tough. But what's important is to recognize this process is taking place. And also, to be able to pay some attention to how you react once this object is recognized and named. So a lot of times, once we recognize something and say, oh, this is such and such of a thing, we have a tendency to stop really paying attention to the object itself as we're experiencing it in the moment, and to focus on our idea or concept of it. And I think Suze gave a really good example about that when she was talking about how we work, how we respond to the body, how it's so easy for us to feel some sensation in the body, like a throbbing or tingling or stabbing, and it goes to, oh, this is that pain in my knee. This is that ache in my shoulder that I always have. So we're with this idea of the thing rather than the actual experience itself. And when we do that, sometimes there can be this sense of, oh, I know what that is, so I don't have to pay any attention to it. You're like, oh yeah, this is just that, like going for a walk. Yeah, that's that tree I see all the time. Oh, it's just this, it's just that. No need to even notice it. And this might be especially true if the object is something that's fairly neutral. There's this sense of, oh, I know that. That's not a problem. Don't need to think about it. Or it might, your reaction on the other hand might be something more like, oh, I know what this is, and this thing is terrible, or this thing is wonderful. You know, so, but the main thing isn't so much just whether it's wonderful or terrible or whatever. It's sort of this idea that we're moving away from the thing itself and to our idea about it. So, you know, we have an idea that it's wonderful or terrible or we don't have to pay attention to it. And yet, well, is that really true? We don't necessarily know that. And this perception, you know, being able to recognize and categorize objects is really a useful thing. And it's a good thing we're able to do this, because if we didn't have it, well, think how confusing our life would be. You know, we'd be constantly inundated by all sorts of forms and stimuli from our environment, and we wouldn't be able to function at all. It would be really difficult. So it's good, you know, that we can recognize things, have some sense of what is familiar and safe and what is unfamiliar. And maybe we have to be kind of careful about it. You know, it's good that we have some sort of kind of mental construct to put our world in. But it's also true that these perceptions we have aren't necessarily all that accurate. You know, on one level, we know that our present experience of something is never quite the same as our past experience, even if it's something familiar. It's never really exactly the same. And so when we rush into our idea of the thing, we're not really fully experiencing what's actually happening in the present moment. It's kind of more like we're experiencing our memory of that thing from before, or our idea of that thing. So in a way, when we rush too quickly into our perception, we're depriving ourselves of really our complete sense experience. And we aren't really able to fully appreciate the uniqueness of that moment or experience. And so that's one problem, but also there are times when our perceptions are just plain wrong. They're way off, you know. We think we recognize one thing and it's really something very different. You know, like for example, if you're walking along in the woods and you see some sort of a crooked vine, but you think it's a snake. Well, you know, your reaction might be way off base if you make a mistake like that. And that's a kind of a dramatic example. Oh, well, maybe not so dramatic in the Pacific Northwest, where a snake is, you know, no big deal, but might be in another area. But these kinds of mistakes of perception happen a lot in our daily lives. You know, we see a certain expression on our friend's face or hear them speaking in a certain tone of voice, and maybe we immediately think, oh, they're angry, they're mad at me. Or maybe we think, oh, they're bored by what I'm saying, you know, and so on and so forth. And maybe that's true, but maybe it isn't really true at all, and something completely different is going on in their mind that has nothing to do with us. And of our perceptions can also be influenced by prejudice and stereotypes. You know, we see a person and we can assume all kinds of things about them based on their gender, their skin color, their accent, the kind of clothes they wear. Often things that really aren't true at all if we actually got to know this person. And so we need to be aware that perception is happening and maybe be willing to question our perceptions. You know, are we really seeing clearly, or are we just seeing our idea of what is there? So then from perception, it's only a very short step to the next aggregate of mental formations. And in fact, that step is so short that I think it's really even hard to tell where the perception ends and the mental formations begin, because they come up so quickly. And this aggregate of mental formations It comes into play when, after you encounter and recognize the object, all of our thoughts and memories and ideas about the object arise in the mind. So as you can see, it's just very closely related and just right on the heels of that perception. And also, in addition to all of these ideas and things, the impulses we might have to act in a certain way toward that object also come up in this aggregate. And a good example that I read in an article about the aggregates from the Fundamentals of Buddhism website was this, and I think maybe this influenced my talk because once again, we're going for a walk. So imagine you go for a walk in a garden and your eyes come in contact with an object. And well, here we go again. With this aggregate of perception, you identify it as a snake. And in this example, it really is a snake. Okay, you identify this snake. So once that happens, you might respond with a feeling of fear or maybe displeasure. And then this aggregate of mental formation comes up. And so all the memories of your past encounters with snakes come up. All the things people have ever told you about snakes might come up. And then there might be intention, an intention of what to do because the snake is there. Maybe this intention to run away and get away from it. Maybe even to pick up a rock or something like that and try to crush the snake. Or, you know, if you were brought up here, you know, in our area where we only have the nice, friendly little garter snakes, you might respond to seeing a snake with pleasure instead of thinking about picking up a rock. It's more like, oh, a snake, how cute, you know. But that's just one example. And this process happens with everything we encounter, you know, and all of these steps happen very naturally. And they happen before we're even hardly aware of them. It's just normal. And yet at the same time, if we don't have some recognition of this process, it's really easy to get ourselves into trouble. Like when we get caught up in our mental formations, for example, we're even more enmeshed in our ideas about the object and farther away from our actual experience of it than we are with the aggregate of perception. And in fact, we may easily find that once these mental formations come into play, that we aren't anywhere near our present moment experience of what's going on with whatever we're encountering, and we're caught up in something that happened in the past. Or maybe in our plans for the future about what we're going to do in reference to this object. We might not even be anywhere near the present moment. We're lost somewhere else in time. And something that may also be even more important is the step where mental formations arise. It's where we form intentions about how we'll react to that object. And when that happens, if we're not paying attention, it's really easy to do something we'll later regret. And instead of just having this idea to do something, we actually go ahead and do it. You know, at this step of mental formation, we might have that idea, but we haven't done it yet. So this is a point where we can pause and decide, you know, should I actually do this? With the example of the snake, maybe we can move away, but we can choose not to kill the snake or harm the snake. So this step where these intentions start to come up is a place to really pay attention, as well as paying attention to see whether we're just really lost somewhere in the future or the past in something that's not really even there, but more our daydream about what's going on. Then finally, we come to the aggregate of consciousness. And this consciousness is the sense of knowing that seeing or hearing or smelling or tasting or whatever is happening. And in the teachings, this consciousness is often divided up by sense organ. So in the suttas, they talk about eye consciousness, which is like knowing that seeing is happening, ear consciousness, knowing that hearing is happening, nose consciousness, knowing that smelling is happening, tongue consciousness, knowing that tasting is happening, mind consciousness, knowing that thinking is happening. And so this kind of consciousness works in combination with the sense organ that's being exposed to whatever this object is out there to create a sense of experience of it. So the consciousness plus the sense organ plus the exposure, it sort of works together to make what we call our personal experience. And that sounds kind of out there, but it makes sense, really, I think. And, you know, with this aggregate, we also realize that this consciousness kind of has to be here for us to have a sense of me having an experience. If there's just the sense organ and some object it comes in contact, that's not enough. Like, for example, the ear might be exposed to a sound or the eye to some kind of visual object. But if we have no consciousness that this is happening, it doesn't really produce any experience that we're really aware of. You know, the consciousness needs to be present as well. The sense of knowing that seeing or hearing or whatever is happening. Like a good example is if you're asleep, a sound might arise, the ear is there to hear it, but you don't hear it, you don't experience the sound because you're not conscious of it. I mean, maybe there's something on a very deep level, but in the way that we really think of it, in like, oh, I hear a sound, that is not happening. And, you know, that happens certainly when we're asleep, that might happen. But I think it also happens a lot of the time during our daily activities when our mind, you know, our attention is focused on one thing and we sort of tune out other things that are around us. So, you know, we might be focused on one object and there are other things we may, you know, sort of see in the periphery of our visual field, but they barely register, or sounds we don't even notice because we're busy thinking about something else. So, but the sense is this kind of consciousness needs to be there for us to have a sense that we are having this experience. And I just might mention too that it's most helpful to think of this consciousness and this aggregate in this sort of simple way of just, you know, awareness that hearing is happening or seeing is happening or thinking is happening or whatever. You know, it's more like that rather than thinking of it as like a consciousness with the capital C or sort of a cosmic consciousness. It's more this simple awareness. Now, this definition sounds simple enough of what consciousness is, but I think that this aggregate of consciousness is, at least for me, it's one of the hardest ones to work with in practice and one of the hardest not to identify with. You know, it really is one of the last holdouts when it comes to taking apart that sense of self, because I know I do, and I think many of us really identify with it so strongly. You know, we really do feel like that thing that knows is me. You know, that sense that I'm seeing, I'm hearing, I'm having this experience. And I don't know, I'm not sure it's even possible not to have that feeling most of the time. for most of us. But we can recognize, even if we don't really recognize it yet experientially, that this feeling of I is also part of a process, part of this aggregates coming together, not so much a permanent and unchanging me, or at least be open to the possibility that this is so, even if we haven't yet had that actual experience. So that was a brief introduction to the five aggregates of form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. And now Susan and I are going to give you some thoughts about working with them in your practice. And we thought about doing this as part of each of our talks, but they're so closely related and we experience them so much as a group that it might be easier to just talk about it separately. So now we're going to spend a little time doing that, and I will let Suze take the floor for a bit to give some of her thoughts about working with the aggregates, since I've been talking for a little while, and then after she's done, I will add some of my thoughts. So Suze, would you like to go?
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Lyndall. I think that not forgetting about Vedana, that it really, when Christina calls it the queen of consciousness, you know, it's so easy to skip over it. And when I said that it's often gives us the pause between the experience and the reaction, I think that's really an important piece. A second suggestion is to really have the experience of the direct body experience of whatever is going on, and learning the difference between the concept of it and the actual sensation that is arising. And to spend some time doing that so that it's kind of like exercising a new muscle. And then it becomes much easier to go, oh, right, I am totally lost in the perception or the mental formation. I'm lost in this concept of whatever. Let me get back to what is actually going on. And so spending some time in your sits with really differentiating between the concept and the experience. And the third thing I'd say is something that comes from a whole bunch of Joseph Goldstein talks, where he suggests changing our language from I am to it is. So when experiences come up and you go, I am afraid, or I am really angry, to try out fear is present, anger has arisen. Just depersonalizing the language can have a real effect on the thinning of our attachment. So those would be the three that I would start with, and then send it back over to you, Lyndall.
Okay, well, I think those are great suggestions, and some of the things I also think about too. And, you know, especially, Suze, what you were talking about recognizing the difference between our actual present moment experience and when we're lost in the concept of it. Mm-hmm. And for me, like, I think there are two main ways that I tend to work with the aggregates. And, you know, like, one thing about them is that they are called the aggregates of clinging. So one way that I think is helpful, or I found helpful, is to look at these individual aggregates and take time to notice where you're getting attached or identifying. You know, with form, with the body, for example, you might notice that you have certain attachment to your idea of your, the appearance of your body or things that it can do or yourself as a person with a healthy body or something like that. Or with feeling tones, maybe sort of an instinctive sense of moving toward the pleasant. Sometimes people might also even have that sort of attachment almost to the unpleasant, where they're so caught up in noticing what's wrong that they have trouble seeing anything else. Perceptions that we are really attached to, we don't want to let go of. Mental formations, we all are aware of how attached we can be to our stories, our memories, our plans. You know, it's like a minefield of identification and attachment. And then that really subtle attachment to consciousness. I mean, I think this is one of the most challenging to work with, you know, to have some sort of sense of, oh, where am I making that subtle identification that what knows is me? The other thing that I think is really helpful is just sort of being aware of the process of how these aggregates are coming together. Because, you know, when we talk about them, they can seem really theoretical in a way. But if we look at our actual experience, we can see that this process is happening all the time. I mean, I think I might have told this story before talking about the aggregates, but it's a pretty good example, so I'll quickly go over it so you get the idea of what I'm talking about. From time to time, I join talks over Zoom with two of my longtime teachers, Steve Armstrong and Kamala Masters, and they're based in Maui. So often during the sits, you will hear these sounds of tropical birds in the background because they might be outside or, you know, with the windows open and stuff. So on a typical day, I was joining the sit and just present, noticing there was sound, you know, hearing was happening, pleasant. And then this perception, you know, this recognition, oh, this is a bird. This is the sound of a bird. And then the thought comes, oh, this is a tropical bird. And then all these mental formations started to come up. Memories of when I'd been on Maui on retreat and heard the birds during sits and walking meditation and, oh, how lovely it is and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, thoughts about the future. Wouldn't it be nice to go back? Maybe I should go and sit. You know, they have a kind of a hermitage area where you can go do retreat and, oh, maybe I should go. Wouldn't that be great? Maybe I should try to do it like in February. The weather is going to be bad here, but it would be nice there. And so before I knew it, I'd gone from simply knowing that hearing was happening to sitting on a hillside in a kuti in Maui, having this, you know, esoteric, beautiful meditation experience. So it's like, and you all have examples like that. And you can all, I think, in your own experience, see how quickly these aggregates come together to form some sense of me, maybe even not the me that's even here now, a me in the future. So just sort of recognizing that this happens is really helpful. And, you know, seeing it as a process and seeing how quickly it can fall apart when something else arises for you to pay attention. I mean, the me sitting on the hillside in Maui, like the doorbell might ring and boom, it's totally gone. So looking at the process is really helpful too. And recognizing when you do that, you begin to see that it's really is a process and it isn't so personal. You know, it's not really all about me, but it's about the processes of the mind, you know, creating that idea. So I hope.
Yeah, and I just one more comment that, you know, we've shared a lot of pretty ordinary, mundane examples, and that is what happens. And when you when you accumulate them, and if that's where you're going all the time, instead of being in the moment that you're experiencing, that accumulation is really a lot of distress, a lot of dukkha. And so when you slow down with a mindfulness practice and you pause and you start looking at what's really happening, that's a way to like break up the accumulation. It's not that we're never going to do that. I think Lyndall's going to be on that hillside in Maui again, and I'm going to be wherever again as well. But when we can see, oh, I don't need to do that right this moment. I can really be just here. We kind of break up some of that tendency to not be clinging to other things and making something that it isn't actually happening. So,
yeah, and we have so much pain and suffering around our ideas of ourselves. Are we good enough? Do we measure up? All of this, these ideas about what we should be. And so I think when we look at the aggregates and begin to kind of see this changeability and instability of what we call me, I think it really helps to ease that suffering. Because if what is me is not all that solid, then it just, you know, there's a certain way that we can be a little bit lighter with what goes on with me. It isn't the end all and be all. And that's a real easing of suffering.